Okay, here we go. Good afternoon and welcome to another edition of The Avid Reader. Today we're pleased to have with us an old friend, B.A. Shapira, who we last spoke to in 2013 after the publication of her international bestseller, The Art Forger. She then was kind enough to appear at our own bookstore, Wellington Square Bookshop, to read and to sign her book, and we had a great dinner together and we had a really good time. Her latest work is The Muralist. It's another historical novel steeped in art and art history. Our protagonist, Danielle Abrams, is a woman who, in the novel, lives in her own world and in the world of her lost aunt, Alizé Benoit. Danielle works as a grunt in Christie's and is the intake person, checking the provenance of newly acquired works. She finds something that changes her life. A square of mural attached to the back of a discarded work by Mark Rothko or Jackson Pollock. The square may be the remnant of a work by her aunt during the Depression when her aunt worked for the WPA, which is the Works Project Administration created by Roosevelt, as were many administrations during the Depression in order to assuage the despair and the lack of employment that everyone suffered. So like so many talented artists, Rothko and Pollock started in that job. So then the book is off to the races, and we travel in one sitting, for me, back and forth between 2015 and the 30s of the Depression, and from New York to Paris and back, literally. So there is a side note, I would say, to this book, and that is halfway through the book, for a moment I thought, I lost sight of the fact that I was reading a novel and thought I was reading a political commentary on today's electoral process. And with that, Barbara, welcome and thanks so much for joining us again.
It's my pleasure.
So before I get into my usual, I don't know, sideline conversations, tell us a little bit about the book, how it came about, and, you know, your, I'll call it, obsession with art and art history.
Well, I have become quite obsessed with art and art history. And when I sat down to write this book after The Art Forger, I knew that those were two things I wanted to include. And I'd always wanted to write a book about the Depression. My parents grew up during the Depression, and it had always fascinated me. The deprivation that they suffered without even recognizing it was deprivation, and also how it affected them years and years later. So I thought, okay, I'll write about art and the Depression. And it turns out when you put these two things together, you get the WPA, Roosevelt's program, to put the country back to work during the Depression. And they hired artists to paint paintings and murals and graphics and actually do sculptures to put into all of the buildings that the WPA was building. They actually paid artists a living wage to create art. Interesting. So I got really caught up in that, and then when I discovered that Mark Rothko and Lee Krasner and Jackson Pollock were all working for the WPA, and they were young and unknown and kind of crazy and jumping in and out of bed with each other and just, you know, drinking and smoking. I thought they would be really fun to write about. So I decided I would have real characters in this book and the artists would be real characters. And then I discovered that Eleanor Roosevelt was integral in convincing Franklin to include artists in the WPA. And I just love her. So I said, okay, cool. She'll be a character. She'll be a character too. And then when I found out that her greatest regret, Eleanor's greatest regret at the end of her life, was that she had not convinced, actually the word she used was forced, Franklin to allow more refugees into this country, I thought, aha, this sounds really interesting. And it just turns out that we have a situation today that is very, very similar to the situation that the refugees faced running from Hitler right before and during World War II. So all the pieces kind of came together, and I threw in some mystery and some romance, and I had a lot of fun with it.
Yeah, it was really interesting and poignant the way you painted Eleanor Roosevelt's last encounter in the book and the pain you could feel that she had, and the fact that she said it was the greatest regret of her life. But you couldn't have known when you wrote the book that what would be happening with Donald Trump was actually going to happen, could you have? You wrote it well before.
No,
that.
I didn't.
It's prophetic.
The book, you know, it takes over a year for a book to be published, so I had this finished by then. But the book is actually about war, and you know, one of the themes that I wanted to get at was that we just keep waging war over and over again, that we don't learn our lessons. And the refugees are the result of war. And, you know, I was talking about World War II, and now we have, you know, whatever you want to call this crazy war with ISIS, but it's the same thing. It's these, you know, nutso people who want to take over the world, and then they push individual innocent citizens out of their country and their homeland, and nobody wants to let them into their own countries.
I know, it's like if you take a pull at any quote, lots of quotes out of your book. One is, for once we allow foreign ships to unload their human cargo, we are allied with those nations.
Yep.
And then the one that Undersecretary Long says is, and this you could just substitute the nationalities, there is no doubt that many of these so-called immigrants are actually fifth columnists, Nazi spies, masquerading as Jews who come here to commit sabotage against our great and generous nation, and this we will not accept.
Which is very close to an exact quote from him.
I know, and it's also very close to an exact quote, if he were eloquent enough,
really?
From Donald Trump.
Yeah, well, it's that same, it's these flaws that we have, the human animal that must wage war and must hate the other. And, you know, and on the other hand, we create such fabulous art, and, you know, some people have such great kindness.
Oh, that's interesting.
We're an interesting species.
The interesting argument is Pollock and Rothko arguing with Alizé. I'm pronouncing it correctly, right?
Alizé. Yeah, Alizé.
About whether art should enter into the realm of politics. And then there's a great deal of talk about Picasso's Guernica. Guernica? Guernica.
Guernica.
And, you know, there are some of the artists are appalled that he would go about, you know, talking about a real life war situation. And that, I guess, really was an argument back in the time, right?
Yeah. Well, you know, I'm sure there are people that still feel that way.
I guess so.
That it's you know, art is not about creating, you know, but using art for political means is cheating, that's not what art is supposed to be. But who's to tell us what art is supposed to be?
Exactly, because, you know, after I started researching your research, and I was looking at Marcel Duchamp and, you know, the fountain, the fact that he brings a urinal into an art gallery, and that's art because it's not. And then in the book, when Danielle goes to Paris and looks in the shop before she finds Josephine's works and is looking at art that's paperclips and Post-its,
yep.
There's lots of people that are not necessarily appalled, but going, well, I could do that, but that's not art, and those kinds of things.
Well, you know, also this another thing I was playing with in the book is how we're so afraid of anything new. So, you know, people were so afraid of abstract art, and they didn't like it. They weren't willing to give it a chance, and that this is something that we also do as human beings over and over again. You know, the same good, different bad.
You're right.
And then it becomes, the book I'm working on now is about the post-impressionists and early modernists, and, you know, people that we think are so fantastic, like Matisse and Cezanne, they thought they were just horrible rogues.
Right, like Monet's water lilies. I mean,
yep.
I remember in the museum sitting there, my experience was very similar to that of Eleanor Roosevelt's, as you describe it. So rather than me describing my experience, why don't you tell our listeners that little paragraph or two paragraphs where Eleanor is looking at something and thinking, oh, I don't understand. This doesn't make any sense. And then the transformation that comes about, how she does that.
Yeah, well, at the beginning of the book, Alizé approaches Eleanor Roosevelt, who has come to the warehouse where the WPA, where they're painting murals. And she asks Eleanor why there aren't any abstract murals that the WPA is supporting. And Eleanor doesn't really know why, so she goes home and she pulls out a bunch of books and looks at abstract art, which she had never looked at before. And so initially she's looking at it and she's going, I have no idea what this is. And then she looks at a painting that actually is of New York City, and she had just left New York City. And it's an abstract painting, which actually really exists. These are, most of the paintings in the book are actual paintings. And it has buildings that are tilted and little figures hovering. And she starts to look at this and look at this, and she realizes that this is the feeling that she gets in New York City. And she starts to recognize the power of not having things exactly as they look, but having things the way they feel.
Yeah, it's funny because I was kind of the same way when I was younger, especially with Jackson Pollock, and you watch those little documentaries where he's just hovering above the canvas and slashing,
right,
doing all those things, and you think, oh, that's ridiculous, a monkey or an elephant, and you've seen those happen. But then if you see on the wall, like the painting Poles, mm-hmm. you stand back from it, and it's gigantic, but you stand back from it and you see exactly what he meant. And you're in wonder because how could he have done it that way? And yet there they are. And it's like an amazing thing that an artist is able to take something from his mind or his soul and transfer it to a realistic medium.
It just is unbelievable. I mean, I don't have any artistic talent. My stick figures don't even look like stick figures. And so I am just in awe of these guys.
Well, if you can't do stick figures that look like stick figures, then you're an abstract expressionist.
That's right. That's what I should do. Except that you can't, you know. It's not as easy as it appears, that's for sure.
Well, it's one of those things that's the things that I find that are impossible to define are those that seem to me most valuable in a lot of ways, like symphonies.
Yeah.
Like if the symphony is supposed to be about, I don't know, the Battle of Waterloo or mm-hmm. the Afternoon of a Faun or something like that, I generally can't understand why it is about that. But if I'm semi-meditative at the symphony, then all of a sudden I understand it completely. But
you know, I never thought about it until you just said it, but that actually is a really good analogy for abstract art that maybe might help people understand it better, that a symphony is conveying emotions. That's really what it does when you listen to music, and these musicians, that's what they're trying to do, and it's not a realistic picture of something, but yet it creates emotion through sound. And abstract art is kind of like that.
Yeah, when I'm at the symphony with my daughters, and I'll be sitting there listening but not quite listening, and then all of a sudden I find myself, like many of the artists in your book, when they don't go to sleep, they're so immersed, they're in the flow.
Mm-hmm.
And all of a sudden I'm in the flow, it doesn't take effort on my part. And then when it's over, I realize, you know, I just understood something, but then I can't explain it.
Right. But maybe it's because words are limiting.
Yes, they very much are.
So it's, you know, music or abstract art or things that are conveying emotion and feeling without words have a very different kind of power.
Plus, you make a point, I guess not repeatedly, but you make a point pointedly about the fact that most of these artists suffer a great deal, either from depression or alcoholism mm-hmm. or suicidal ideation or suicide. Mm-hmm. And I like the way you stuck Axl Rose in there. That was hilarious. There's a couple things.
Churchill.
Yeah, but there's a couple of things in there that remind me of when you were at the bookstore. It's like, this isn't the novel. This is her. She's saying this. Like when Daniel says it gave me the creeps or something like that. It's like, you know, that's her. That's not Daniel.
But yeah, this whole aspect of creativity and mental illness is just fascinating. And the statistics that I quote in the book are true. It's not causality that is happening here, but there's a strong correlation between the creative person, writers, artists, politicians, musicians, and and a greater chance of suffering from mental illness, bipolar disorder in particular.
I think pain taps into something that you're otherwise not necessarily.
My brother said to me once, he said that I could never be a great novelist because I had a happy childhood.
I think that's kind of true, actually.
there is something, but I just don't have those depths of pain because I've had such a good life. Why I have to go with story.
And it's funny how you talk about Alizé staying up, like I was saying, staying up all night, not even knowing that a minute has passed, because it always reminds me of Kafka, who I love, and the fact that, you know, he wrote Metamorphosis in one night. I don't even think he wanted to write it, you know?
Is this... I mean, that it just is incredible. It's like, seems impossible to me that he could have done that.
But... I know. You know, some of the things in your book were really telling in the sense that, and I know you're very careful not to let your research show, but it's meticulous. And at the end, your little explanation at the end is really good because you say, hey, look, you know, this is not history. It's historical fiction. This is what I've done. This is what's true. That was very helpful and I think also entertaining.
Thanks.
But, like, I had no idea about, explain about Lyndon Johnson. I had no idea about that.
I didn't either. I mean, that's the thing that's so much fun about doing this research. So it turns out that Lyndon Johnson, as a very young senator, I guess he was in the House, representative, he single-handedly went out and saved a number of Jews and got visas for them and brought them in secretly through Galveston, Texas, and resettled them. And this is like a hidden part of his biography that I had no idea of. And I mean, that was taking a huge risk as a young politician, which is contrasted with the risks that Franklin Roosevelt was not willing to take for the refugees.
It changed my whole opinion of him as a politician. I kind of didn't like him, but liked him. And then I understand now kind of why he wouldn't run in 1968, because the idea of continuing a war that he didn't believe in, and you know what I mean? It's like,
yeah, we were so against him in those days because of the Vietnam War. But when you think about what he did, I mean, this actually, what he did with the refugees makes sense. You know, he created the Great Society. He cared about civil rights. He cared about poverty. And we just saw him through that single lens of Vietnam.
And he didn't want to be there. And he didn't create it. Kennedy actually created it, which is so strange when you think about
it. Right. He doesn't get any of the blame. He gets all the glory, and Johnson got all the blame when in reality he was quite a cool guy.
Yeah. So that changed my whole that one little area changed my whole opinion of him. There's something funny though that you said in the book. You talk about how Danielle searches the web for Alizé Benoit and there's not one hit. So I did the same thing. And there is one hit, and there is an Alizé Benoit. She's a gymnast, and she's a gymnast that she with hoops, you know, like so she.
Really.
Yeah, and so and the only reference to her goes to a YouTube video of her actually performing.
That's too bad. I didn't do that. That would have been a good thing for Danielle to have seen.
Yeah, it's. That's, you know, actually that actually what she's doing, the gymnast, is abstract expressionism. She's taking a hoop and creating a story with it. You have to watch it.
Now you tell me.
I think I did that last time, too.
Lost opportunities.
Well, the thing is, your books make me, here's what happens, is I'm reading your book, and then all of a sudden I see this about Lyndon Johnson, and thank God for Wikipedia, and then I go there, and I was reading your book a minute ago, and now I'm not.
I know, which actually I'm not so crazy about. One of the sales people said, we should put links into the Kindle version. And I'm like, no, I don't want people popping out of the book all the time.
I know. No, you're right. You're 100% right. That's what's so good about reading a real book. You don't have the opportunity, and you're, you know, you're the way you should be, up in the tree with an apple reading a book.
I nixed that idea.
I can't, there's a couple of spoilers towards it. Well, there's a major spoilers, but you know, it's funny when you describe in the book, like Union Square, and I had just been in Union Square the day before, and you realize how a lot of Union Square hasn't changed from the day that you described it in the 30s, you know?
I know, there's so few places like that, but there are some places in New York City that exist the way they existed.
Yeah. The other thing that was interesting was talking about minutiae, I guess, is that, and I went back to Wikipedia on this one too, is when you talk about Jackson Pollock, and then I find out that he made this great apple pie. and then in Wikipedia has the recipe for his apple pie.
I mean, sorting through the minutiae is really fun. But again, you have to be careful, as I said before,
yep,
about not getting too researchy and not letting, you know, don't let your research show, because it isn't history. You know, it's a novel and it's a story. And, you know, what people learn on the side is great, but mostly I want them to be taken with the story.
Yeah, and searching for your family or going to the Holocaust Museum, whichever Holocaust Museum
yeah.
you go to, and when Danielle's sitting there crying and the woman goes by and hands her a tissue,
yeah.
all that, well, I'm Jewish too, so all that resonated so much with me because my grandfather attempted to bring, you know, his family over. Actually, this was in the early 1900s during the pogroms and the in Belarus, the diaspora, and he couldn't convince them, just like people in America now cannot be convinced that, or people in the 30s in Germany would just look at Hitler and say, oh, he's a buffoon. The Jews would say,
right.
he's a buffoon, he'll be gone, don't worry about it.
Right.
And history does tend to repeat itself. And
that's the scary part, isn't it?
We're in a mess right now, aren't we?
Oh, God. I mean, it's staggering, but
I
always remind myself when I was growing up in the 60s, they had us ducking underneath our desks for drills for the bomb. And as a young girl, I thought that we were all going to be blown up.
You and I are kind of contemporaries, and I was under a very similar desk, and 1962 was Cuba Missile Crisis.
Yeah,
and
I thought it was all over. I remember watching Kennedy. So, you know, we always think the moment that we're in is the worst, or writing this book, World War II. I mean, Europe at that time was so, so horrendous. And as bad as things are now, I mean, Hitler was winning. He could have won.
Could have won easily.
Yeah, and you and I wouldn't be here.
No, or else we'd be speaking. Well, no, you and I would definitely not be here, but everyone else would be speaking German. But yeah, I would have been in a boxcar a long time ago.
Yeah, and you know, this is the message that, you know, we need to get out to people, is that this is not the right way to treat people. This isn't the right thing to do. We're human beings. What Eleanor said, you know, we're human beings, and they're human beings.
But the thing is, when I think about it, if I think about the fact that, you know, Timothy McVeigh or the Sandy Hook
mm-hmm.
massacre, those killed more people than jihadists have killed in America in the past since 9/11. And no one seems to, I mean, why can't I explain that to someone? Why is it?
Because people don't want to hear it. You know, it's like, you know, white guys with guns have killed a lot more people than terrorists.
100,000 a year.
You know, it's so we're going to get rid of all the white guys with guns? No, that's not what's going to happen here. It gets so out of perspective, and the media is a part of it, and, you know, the NRA is a part of it, and campaign finance, which gives NRA the power. What? Don't get me started.
I know, I'm thinking I'm losing half of your readership here. Sorry. I did
right.
this last
yeah,
time,
yeah,
too.
Right. Don't get me started.
Well, I did read this morning in Google News that in Thailand, somebody's going to be sentenced to between 37 and 40 years for making fun of the king's dog on his Facebook page. So
yeah.
We're not that bad yet.
Right. We're not that bad yet.
I know. I get you off in these tangents where I'm thinking while you're talking, I'm thinking, oh, stop.
Right.
Some white guy with a gun is not going to read the book.
I know. I don't think a guy with a gun is really my reader anyway.
Probably not. Although, who knows, you know?
Who knows? I don't know, you know? I mean, it's...
Everybody...
Which is why I normally don't do politics, but this is your fault. You're the one who led me into this.
I know, on purpose. But I didn't... I'm sorry. I'm sorry I did it. But I thought it was so interesting. And it is kind of your fault, too, because what you did in the book, not knowing what this election cycle would be like, is you – don't tell me you weren't trying to – you were. A good portion of the theme of the book was exactly what we've just spoken about, is like treating human beings that like they're human beings and not denying them the right to.
And also, you know, that politics, one of the reasons, or probably the major reason that Roosevelt did not let more refugees in, is because he didn't want to use up his political capital. And he was running for president. And when you're running for president, you have to be very careful.
Yeah, it's somewhat Machiavellian, but at the same time, it's...
It's real. I mean, it's reality.
There's two ways to look at it. You could look, you know, the road to hell is paved with good intentions, or look, in order for me to do the better good, I have to do it this way. But of course, he was running for a third term, so.
And that was essentially what he was saying. You know, if he didn't win, then Wilkie would have been president, and he would have been worse to the refugees.
That's very, very true. Oh, talk about what you fictionalize, but what is really true, and you actually use some of the language, is about Joseph Kennedy, who I can't stand, and Charles Lindbergh, who I can't stand. Talk about
that. Charles Lindbergh and Joe Kennedy were arch isolationists, along with the villain of the book, whose name is Breckinridge Long, who most people don't know anything about. And these men did not want to get involved in the war, and they were all pretty anti-Semitic, and they pressured Roosevelt and you know, the Congress not to let them in, and made up things such as all the Jews were German spies, kind of like how all the Muslims are terrorists. And they were very, very powerful men. And so Alize comes into they become her enemies. And Breckinridge Long, who was Assistant Secretary of State under Roosevelt and an old friend of Roosevelt's, was in charge of visas, and Congress had already approved all of these visas, and all of these refugees had been vetted, and we now know that Breckinridge Long kept 200,000 of these refugees out of this country who had legitimate visas, and we know what happened to them, which gives you pause about events today.
Yeah, except events today, even the concept of letting 200,000 anythings into this country is anathema. I mean, even 10,000 was like, horrible, horrible thing to think about.
And that's what it was then, too. But these were people who were running for their lives.
I have a – here, let's go away from politics, okay?
Okay. Good plan.
Let's go to, like, female beauty. So Alize and Lee both seem very attractive. Well, no, Lee is attractive in one way. And Alize is attractive, but in a completely other way. Mm-hmm. And you dispose of this in several short paragraphs, but it does give you the ability to, especially when she confronts Long and removes her scarf to. But she sounds like she was beautiful.
Yes.
And it's a good cover, too. It's a really nice cover, don't you think?
You want to hear a funny story about the cover?
Yeah.
So for anybody listening, the cover has this haunting picture of a young, beautiful woman, and you can tell just looking at her that there's something very, very sad about her. But she looks strong. And so I'm doing a signing in New York City, and there's a woman in the back row who looks kind of familiar, and often people, you know, from other parts of my life show up these signings. So while I'm talking, I'm trying to figure out who she is, and I don't know. And she comes up to me afterwards and holds the book next to her face, and she says, "Hi, I'm Sarah, and I'm on your cover."
Wow.
And then, you can't make this up, then she tells me that her mother's name is Shapiro.
Wow. Well, how did she, who is she? How did it?
Well, it's interesting. She is actually a comedian, which is the opposite of what you would think from the photo on the cover. And she swapped with the photographer. She modeled for him for a day, and he did headshots for her. So once again, neither artist was making any money. They just swapped.
Right.
So she had no idea that this was, you know, going to be on a book cover.
That's amazing.
Yeah, and she didn't get paid for it. I mean, you know, the photographer got paid for his photograph, but she had, you know, she was the model.
But it's such a period look. You know, it looks like it's right from when it's supposed to be.
Yeah, it's, you know, well, what the Algonquin, my publisher, did is they, I assume this is how it happened, they bought the photograph, and then they did a lot of graphics around it. So I don't know how, you know, whether the coloring affected, gave it that old look, which is what we wanted.
Yeah, it does have a sepia tone, and you're right, everything is photoshopped. So, but still, my point was, I really like the cover.
Well, thank you.
And so did you get a chance? Did you vet the cover? Did you see it and go, "Wow, I love this"? Or
no, actually, I didn't. You know, the covers and titles are marketing, and basically publishers believe that writers don't know much about marketing, and the truth is that we don't.
They're right, yeah.
And I was actually, I had pictured a cover that would look more like a Pollock painting, you know, something that was going to be bright and more abstract, and they wanted something very representational. And so we went back and forth and back and forth, and then they won.
It sounds like a WPA argument. Oh, talk about... Oh, go ahead. Sorry. I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
I was going to say, why don't you talk a little bit about Alizé's grand scheme, which was slightly insane, about how she was going to substitute murals.
Yes, it was quite insane. So Alizé was very taken with Picasso's Guernica, which was an anti-war, very, very large painting, almost mural-like. And she came up, she was getting so frustrated, she's trying to get her Jewish family out of German-occupied France, and she needs visas, and she comes against Breckinridge Long and Joe Kennedy and Charles Lindbergh, and she's having a lot of trouble getting these visas, and she's getting a little bit nuttier and nuttier as time goes on. And she decides she's going to paint a mural, an anti-war mural, and she is painting a mural for the WPA, and her idea is that she's going to sneak in the night before the mural is to be unveiled and substitute that mural for her anti-war mural. A lot of things ensue from there.
You know, the other thing... And we can talk a little bit more about how she became unhinged and how Mark became unhinged. But I don't know if you wanted to do this or you were trying to, not trick, but... So when she was with Mark and they were talking about Mark and him being so handsome and all that, I didn't think Mark Rothko. Was I not supposed to? Because it took me like 60 pages before I realized, oh, that's who she's with.
You didn't realize that? He was in the first chapter.
I know he was, but it was just Mark. Because I checked it. It was just his first name. And for some odd reason, I didn't equate the first and the last name. And I'm a pretty close reader. You know that, right?
Yeah.
So
I didn't say Mark Rothko early in the book.
I don't think so. I must have. If you did, I missed it. No, you talked about Mark Rothko, definitely. But when they would say, when Lee says, oh, go over to Mark. He's such a great, beautiful bear of a man or whatever she said.
Uh-huh.
I didn't. I just thought... Silly. You kind of like sideswiped me or like, you know, diverted me.
I didn't mean to do that.
But I think it was kind of cool because then 60 pages in, I go, oh my God, that's who she's with. So that was good.
Well, as long as it worked for you.
It worked really well. So anyway, yeah. So what decided you to, there's an early incident in Alizé's life that I guess you can talk about because the reviews do, but that's up to you. And, so what decided you to create this attachment disorder, which is what it became, and why did you decide to go that way and at the same time weave together Mark Rothko's own illness, if you will?
Yeah, well, Mark Rothko did suffer, as did Jackson Pollock, from bipolar disorder, and Mark Rothko did kill himself, and it's questionable, you know, I think Jackson Pollock did also. He was serious alcoholic, and he crashed his car going 90 miles an hour into a tree. So it's and this bipolar disorder is very common. But that wasn't really what I thought was Alizé's problem. And so I thought about what had happened. She lost her parents very young, and she went over to France and was raised by her aunt and uncle. And it struck me that she was suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder, losing her parents like that. And it was in a pretty tragic visual way. And so that's where that whole idea of detaching from herself came from. And then it ended up weaving itself. It's kind of interesting. You come up with these ideas, and then some, and you start with an idea, and then some of them drop off, and other ones weave in and out. And that one I just got really interested in, this idea that she's hovering above herself, watching herself, and, you know, not seeing herself as other people see her, or seeing herself in a different way. And it kind of fit in with all the visual stuff and the abstract stuff. You know, she looks in the mirror and it looks fractured. It's really interesting. I had an interesting time with that whole mental illness thing.
When you did the fractured thing, it was cool because it was like her teacher who rips the pieces up and rearranges
it. Right, who ripped it up. And that was something that just happened. I had had that where Hans Hoffman had ripped up her painting like that. And then when it fractured, it was like it came back and went, it's just like that. That's how you know that it's a good idea.
Well, it's like, let me see, I was going to say something about Mark, but before I say that, you know me enough to know that I'm a little off too. So,
aren't we all?
I didn't expect you to agree so quickly. But have you had those moments where you float above yourself and watch yourself doing something? And
I have a couple of times, yeah.
I have too. And when I practiced law and I was in a trial, I would always float above myself, watching myself cross-examine a witness. Yeah, it was very effective.
Interesting.
I think there is something effective about being able to separate yourself from your actions at times. It gives you more.
Well, you can see yourself and things in a different way, which is what artists are always trying to do. I hadn't thought about it as lawyers, but I can see that it would be beneficial.
Yeah, because you
see the whole.
Yeah, you see the whole courtroom. You see the jury's reaction. You see yourself from behind and above as you're approaching the witness stand.
Huh?
It's very interesting. I could write a book about that if I could write a book. So I like the way that as everything's unraveling and she's leaving and she's doesn't have time to talk to Mark, and she has to get the hell out of there for so many reasons. I love the way she tells him, this is how you need to change your art to make it work. What made you do that? It's like, okay, I get these. I know what his blocks look like. Oh, she told him to do this. And then I'm starting to think this is real, which is why.
That part isn't real.
I know, but I didn't know that. And I mean, I did know it, but I suspended disbelief. And then that's why it was nice to have your little ending where you said, hey, don't believe everything I write.
Right. I am a novelist. This is fiction.
I am allowed to lie.
I felt that it was, well, there are this whole idea of there being a missing link is something that exists in art. And often they talk about it in one artist's oeuvre. So, and this is what forgers, going back to my first book, The Art Forger, this is what forgers often do, is there'll be a block of art that's missing from, you know, the beginning to the end, and then they forge the paintings that fill in, and that's one of the ways that they get it authenticated, because it fits in with the whole overall scheme of a particular artist's work. So I just decided I wanted to play around with that with abstract expressionism, and it gave Danny in the present, Alizé's niece, something to hold on to and to argue with her bosses about, and give her another thing to, you know, come to fruition at the end. Because I feel it's very important. I find this lacking in a lot of contemporary novels where the ending kind of peters out without closing with satisfaction. It doesn't mean everything has to be neatly tied up. I don't like it when it's all neatly tied up. But I feel like it's important for the reader to feel that the questions that they had in their mind were answered. And so this was one question from the beginning that is answered, that Danny answers at the end.
Yeah, and a very nice, and you know, for a while you think, oh, she's not going to get the answer. You did a good job on that, too.
Thank you.
But you also did a really cool segue between The Art Forger and this book when Danny's whining about, not whining, but she's saying, you know, it's so it's so much easier to forge this new stuff because you can find the paints, you know, you don't radioactive date them, you can find the right canvases because it's all modern.
Yep.
And so
yep.
it's a lot easier.
Completely different thing. Which, I mean, and that's just what happened, you know.
Right. And that immediately harkened me back to The Art Forger, where it was much more difficult to, you know, to accomplish that same goal.
It was fun.
Yeah. I like I said, I really, really enjoyed this in some ways. I mean, I enjoyed both books, but this one was just, and like, I just think you were great, but I think you're getting better and better.
Oh, thank you.
Don't
that's
you?
I think this is a better book. You know, it's more complicated, it's more intricate. It's dealing with more serious themes while still hopefully being a page turner. And I'm very proud of it. But I know there are going to be, and, you know, obviously there are people that like The Art Forger better because it's just a quicker, lighter read. But I think this is, I believe this is a better book.
And, you know, and I think a part of it is because, for whatever reason, it does bring you to the present, like we talked about a little bit. And also because, like you, my parents have that same depression mentality. My mother will go to the store and look at a bottle of Goulden's mustard, and I think I may have told you this before, and if she's not sure whether she has one at home already, she'll drive back to her house and check, and then she'll go back to the market, and I tell her, Mom, you're spending more in gas
than the cost of mustard. Well, one of my mother's stories is she called me one day. She said, I saved you a good laugh. And I'm like, why did you save me a good laugh? She said, well, I was in my closet, and I realized that I had dozens of plastic bags filled with plastic bags. And I had this image of you that I'm dead, and you're cleaning out my closet. And you look at this, and you're going, Mom, what the hell are you doing with all these plastic bags? So she said she threw them out.
Or my mother. For dessert, when we were little, she would buy like a Mounds bar, and she would cut it up into 6 pieces, and we would each get a piece.
Yeah, well, this really interests me, the historical moment that we're in. You know, we talk about nature and nurture, and although you could make the argument that the historical moment is the nurture part, I think it's something separate. So when you grow up during the Depression, this is every little thing is very precious, and you don't know where it's coming from, the next one is going to come from, so you're very careful. We grew up during the 60s, and that, you know, the civil rights and the sex, drugs, and rock and roll and all of that stuff affects who we are still today. And so I was trying to get at that. Somewhat in, you know, living in pre-World War II America, particularly as a woman, how different was life then and how different were their life chances? Like Alize, her, you know, because of her historical moment, that's why everything happened to her the way it did. Danny, on the other hand, is also a struggling artist, and she doesn't have those kinds of constraints. She has other constraints.
Right, it's good. It's nice the way you described Alize's loft and the fact by the 30th or the 31st of the month, there's not much left. And also, they don't go to the, what's the name of the bar?
The Jumble Shop.
Yeah, the Jumble, which did exist.
Yes, that's real. And they all went there.
Wow.
They were all hanging out there.
Except on the 30th and the 31st when
they... yeah, when they didn't have any money. Except maybe Bill de Kooning would come by and buy them a drink.
Oh, which reminds me of Louise, too. And
yeah.
How did Louise get in there, and who is she?
Louise is a completely fictional character, but she kind of stands for, I had a not dissimilar character in The Art Forger, the side of any artistic community where people are undercutting each other rather than supporting each other. And so all of these people were real, you know, like Pollock and Rothko and Krasner and Alizé and de Kooning, they were all very, very supportive of each other. But, you know, quite often, whether it's writers or artists or actors or dancers, there's a little bit of sabotage and undercutting going on. So that's where Louise came from.
Plus, you double it up because she's kind of a poser too, right?
I mean, right. Right, yes, a poser in a different way than people usually pose.
Right.
A reverse poser.
Yeah, but there is, yeah, there's a betrayal, and the betrayal is well portrayed as well.
Right.
Well, in any event, I think I could go on like I always do, but thank you so much for being here. And
Thank you.
And so when it comes out in paperback, maybe you'll come back and see us again?
Yes, I will talk to my publicist about it, and also you'll probably be interested in my new book, which takes place in Philadelphia.
Ooh.
And Paris. And is very roughly based on Albert Barnes and the Barnes Foundation and his right-hand woman, Violetta DiMaggio.
Oh, I could go on and on about the Barnes Foundation and them moving it and all that stuff.
I have lots of thoughts about that. So that's what the new book is about.
Okay, I'm definitely interested in that. That would be great.
I will put your request into my publicist.
Thanks so much.
And hopefully we can do it, because all my Philadelphia cousins are whining because I haven't been there yet.
Well, they'll love the new book, too.
Yes.
Okay.
Well, some of them will and some of them won't.
Well, yeah, it's definitely a polarizing topic.
Yeah,
no,
it's very
about
polarizing.
It. Okay, thanks again, and I'll talk
okay,
to you soon.
Okay, it was great to talk to you, Sam. Really appreciate it.
So, that was B.A. Shapiro, who I now consider a good friend, and hope to see her again soon. You heard her next novel, one of her next novels, will be dealing with Philadelphia and the Barnes Museum, and you know how I feel about it being moved. When you put in your will something, they should stick to your will and not move it around and destroy the assets and all that. But like she says, there'll be people who disagree with that. In any event, I would highly recommend The Muralist. It's a great book club book, and we will probably feature it with our book club. And we've just been voted by the Daily Local best book shop in Chester County. We'll put the banner up in a couple of days. And if you don't know where we are, we're in Eagle View, which is hard to find for some people. It's just off of Route 100, about quarter of a mile north of the Turnpike, and a mile or two before you get to the Eagle Tavern. You drive in, follow the signs to the shops. There's Brookside Restaurant, there's Nudie's, there's Rita's, there's my bookshop. We're building a new building that'll contain some more restaurants. So it's a really vibrant area. It has a town square where we have concerts in the summer on Tuesdays. We have movie nights. We have, right now there's Santa and then reindeer and sleighs and things like that. So it's a really nice area in the middle of the Eagle View community in Exton, Pennsylvania. Let's see. So what do we have coming up? Let me look at my notes. Oh, yeah, we have this guy, Sunil Yapa. He wrote this book called Your Heart is a Muscle the Size of a Fist, and it deals with the World Trade Organization and the riots that occurred in Seattle back in the 80s. And a lot of it is very similar to what Barbara's writing about in terms of protest and I guess the illegality, or in my view, the evil that sometimes lurks in multinational corporations or countries that wish to control the ebb and flow of energy and material goods. But it does it in a very, very different kind of way. But the thing is that the publishing house had published it. They weren't even going to open the publishing house until 2016. Then someone sent them this manuscript that landed on somebody's desk, and they decided, hey, we're going to go ahead and start our own publishing house 1 year earlier because we love this book so much. And it really, really is good. So that's the next one we got. And then that'll be, I guess, it. And then we'll be starting to line up our characters, our list of characters for 2016. And hopefully you'll be with us for that entire year. and hopefully I'll be with you for the entire year. So thanks so much for joining us, I hope you had a great holiday, and I hope you have a great 2016, and thank you as always for taking the time to join us here on The Avid Reader. Thank you.